Welcome to Worlds Apart. The world may have long become a global village, but the rules and lifestyles practiced in one corner of that village are often the very opposite of what's allowed or afforded in the other part. As developed countries continue vocalizing their concern about the degradation of the environment, they still export much of their garbage overseas and continue investing in high pollution energy projects in developing countries. Is authentic environmental justice even possible before the Earth passes the point of no return? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Syed Rizwan Hassan, Chief Executive of the Bangladesh Environmental Lawyers Association. Rizwan, it's great to see you. Good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I'm particularly grateful for this conversation and for the chance to talk to you because I really like your approach. I think you approach this very complicated, very sciencey issue in a very human way that is easy for an ordinary person to understand. So instead of talking about, let's say, limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, as most scientists do, you speak about the quality of air that we breathe every second of our lives. And that led me thinking is what if one of the reasons why ecological issues are not addressed as they should be is because they are formulated in a way that is very hard for most people to grasp and to practice.
That's very correct. When we talk about climate change, and we work with the communities, they don't really say climate change, but they'll explain their everyday difficulties to you. And by listening to their everyday difficulties, me being a person exposed to what's happening globally, I instantly realize that it's happening because of climate change. So people don't know what IPCC stands for. They really do not understand what COP stands for or what UNFCCC or mitigation stands for. But they are the ones who are feeling the impact of our injustices being done to the environment. So it is their language that is most important. And what IPCC says is exactly what my farmers are saying. What IPCC says is exactly what my fishermen are saying. But they just have different language. Mm-hmm. And climate change has so much an impact on our everyday life, on the well-established human rights, that giving it a human language is not very difficult. Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking about injustices, both to the environment and as a result to the people who live on those lands, you often use the concept of ecocide in your public work. How do you define it?
As we hear, every day we are losing forest area, which is the size of Portugal. So what we are doing to the green cover of this world is nothing but ecocide. And I say this because we are doing with full knowledge about the consequences of our work. We know that if we destroy forests, the challenges of climate change will increase manifold. Still, we are doing it on different grounds for which alternatives exist. So this is ecocide because what you are destructing cannot be restored very easily. You can't create a forest. You can't create a river. You can create 100 stadiums. You can create thousands of townships, but you can't recreate a forest. You can't recreate a river. And you know that you are actually destroying something that you can't recreate. And this destruction will have serious negative impact on some communities in some part of the world.
Well, speaking about that, I think one of the problems here is that the impact will be most noticeable in the indigenous communities, people who still live off the land. But people in bigger cities, you know, who don't have many trees around them, they sort of don't even notice that, apart perhaps from the, you know, the quality of air or the quality of water, which in many cities is more or less okay right now. How do you think it could be made relatable to the sort of an average urban citizen of the earth, to make him not only be abstractly concerned about the, you know, the disappearing forest somewhere, let's say in South America, but actually to be concerned about what surrounds him on an immediate, or her on an immediate basis?
In my part of the world, it is no longer an issue of abstractly connecting someone with the adverse impact. Because I live in Dhaka, the most populated capital of the world. And it is often ranked as one of the most unlivable cities of the world. So the city dwellers here also, the rich people here also, are facing the impact of pollution. So people who are super rich, living in the capital of Bangladesh, also inhales the same poisonous air that someone else is inhaling elsewhere. So when we contaminate environment, when we destroy nature, the impact of it is felt by everyone. And also to answer your question, this time we are having serious food crisis in the world. And if we destroy our agriculture land, if we destroy our traditional knowledge around food production, the climatic threats become even more acute and severe for you, because you then become dependent on food being produced elsewhere, which is not something that's very sustainable. I live in a city where the temperature is 3 degrees higher already from the neighboring townhoods. You know why? Because the other townships haven't chopped off the trees. But in Dhaka, in the name of development and in our pursuit to become a capital like Singapore, we are all going for urbanization and just covering all the greens with concrete. So when you destruct nature, it takes a revenge on you. Whether you are rich or poor, it doesn't really make that difference.
I agree with you, Rizwana. And then something in me wants to argue with this thesis, because sure, the impact is felt, because ultimately we have one planet to inhabit, but the impact is different for people in Bangladesh than, let's say, for people in the United States, which brings me to this old question of who should be responsible for making and funding those great changes that are necessary. Correct me if I'm wrong, but as things stand now, about 10% of the world's population is responsible for nearly half of the global emissions. And that figure may become even more lopsided if we factor in all the production chains, for example, you know, products manufactured in Bangladesh for the consumption in Great Britain. And then you add all the shipping, and then shipping back of the garbage. And sometimes, you know, people, including myself, come to a conclusion that this ecological movement in some of the rich countries has become a way of cleaning their own land at the expense of somebody else's land. Am I exaggerating here?
No, you are not at all exaggerating. That is the reality. We have all embraced an economic model that perhaps is not delivering. It's not delivering for the majority of the people. It is delivering for a few oligarchs. And that is why we always see that the more stronger our demand, the demand of the most vulnerable countries due to climatic change is getting stronger for a transition from fossil fuel to renewable, the more resistance we are actually facing from the fossil fuel industry, because their economics and our economics are clearly different. Having said that, if you notice what has happened this year in UK itself, the heat that UK people had to went through, that is unprecedented. So they probably in the developed country, there is a notion that it will not touch their lives, or if even if touches their lives, they'll be able to deal with it. I don't think the magnitude of the problem, if not addressed from the core, will allow any of us to deal with it at ease in comfort. In the UK, it is not only the temperature rise that one has to notice. One has to also notice the fact that this very country, which is known for its democracy, had three prime ministers in just 2-3 months. So this economic model is not only destroying the nature, it is also not delivering to the needs of the developed countries, because it's very exploitative in nature. Mm-hmm. And thinking that me being in the US or in Canada or in Russia, I'll not be, you know, impacted by it, that perhaps is not going to happen. We have to take lessons from what is happening in UK and all the natural disasters that are happening around us. And they're not happening only in India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, or in Africa. They're happening in the developed country as well.
Absolutely, but they are not affecting those developed countries as much as some of the developing countries that you mentioned. And maybe I'm too tendentious, but I think when it comes to various international environmental fora, the most common dynamic is still for the developing nations or the most affected nations to sort of try to guilt trip wealthy countries into providing some money, while the developed countries still continue with sort of exporting their environmentally unfriendly policies onto the developing world. And sometimes it looks really like a kickback payment for the preservation of the status quo, and both sides agree with that. Now, you are arguing for a change of paradigm. How do you think it could be implemented, and who should be the initiators of that change?
It is not only some money that is being demanded. It is being demanded on clear grounds of responsibility. The developed countries don't want to accept the term liability, but end of the day, it is the damage that is being paid for the loss that that is being caused. And the loss is actually being caused by the very exploitative model of development of the developed countries. And also, it is not only a call for money, it is also a call for system change, as you have rightly placed. And we have seen that before the war, there was changes started very slowly, though. For example, Germany gave a declaration that with it will not be using coal anymore. And then UK also, in the COP that was held in Scotland, pressed hard for a phase out from coal. But then because of pressure coming from the developing world also, the compromised language was phased down. So the problem is, we are asking for a system change, but we are doing that being under the influence of those who are responsible for this. For example, if you see the negotiation team that the US takes to the COP for climate, they have many players from the fossil fuel industry. Their economy is dependent on the fossil fuel industry. When you fight against malaria, you don't really take mosquitoes with you, do you?
Rizwan, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back to this discussion in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Sayeda Rizwana Hassan, Chief Executive of the Bangladesh Environmental Lawyers Association. Rizwana, just before the break, we were talking about how difficult it is to initiate the change. And I don't know if you would agree with that, but I think the issue of lifestyle is crucial here because over the last several decades, perhaps even more, this Western lifestyle, which as you said, and I agree with that totally, is being sustained through the reliance on the rest of the world and through very exploitative and sometimes ironclad reliance on the rest of the world. It's being propagated through media, through movies as something that everybody aspires to. And it is pretty clear from all the calculations that people, we cannot afford that kind of a lifestyle to everybody on this planet because we will need another two or three planets to exploit. Do you think it's possible, do you think it's realistic to arrive at a certain definition, a certain view of a lifestyle that will be dignified, socially desirable, and at the same time respectful to the environment and allowing for the generation of the nature that we are using?
I very much think it's possible. And this is a confusion that we see in my generation and in the next generation. When we say sustainable lifestyle, we often think that we do not know the answer of this question. Here in Bangladesh, all the children really want to go abroad for studies. They want to go to developed countries. They want to build up their career there because they are very comfortable with the amenities that the developed countries offered them. But I can see a definite change in the younger generation now, but I'm coming to that later. When people ask me what is sustainable lifestyle, I say the life of a farmer, a wealthy farmer in Bangladesh is a sustainable lifestyle. He has all the things that are needed for a decent and comfortable living. He has all the things that meet his needs, but he does not have greed. So he does not ask for more and more and more and more. And he does not ask it from others. On the other hand, the exploitative model is actually building their fortune on the putting the earth and putting others at risk. So I think it's more the greed and the need thing. When you address that, you very easily find the definition of sustainable living. And here in Bangladesh, every time our politicians tell us about growth, they tell us very soon we will become like the developed countries. But it is the model of the developed country that is the reason for this catastrophe of climate change. But that we don't take into consideration. I think a lot has to do with developing a consciousness in the next generation. And this time, attending the COP, I have come back with a very positive feeling, number one, because our leaders this time felt the pressure from their communities and they wanted to come back with some definite commitment. Second, this time we saw the children chanting slogan for climate justice. So I expect responsible citizenry and responsible leadership from the new generation.
I want to bring in the question, the issue of globalization, which sure lifted millions of people out of poverty, but it also has its shadow side in a sense of outsourcing all the negatives. For example, you know, shipping the garbage of Western countries to Asian countries, or air pollution for nonstop production, or inhumane working hours, what have you. And I wonder if this more balanced, more ethical lifestyle, more in tune with your land lifestyle, is possible within the concept of globalization. Because you know, if everything is global, it's hard to understand who is responsible for this little corner of the world.
It is very important for us to be critical, but it is also important for us to be hopeful. We can't change the things if we start losing faith in every process and in every institution. You see, I am a neighbor of Bhutan, and I very proudly see how Bhutan is protecting its nature, at the same time mainstreaming with the globalization. So they have got their safeguards. For example, the constitution of Bhutan clearly says that you will never be destroying forests to an extent that it comes down below 60%. Bhutani children have got the right set of education, I must say. Look at Rwanda. They are dealing with the plastic minis very successfully. So the consumption and the consumptive attitude has been handled very nicely with the right set of rulers in the driving seat in Rwanda. In our part of the world, communities, civil societies are working to find out transition from fossil fuel to 100% renewable. We are having a hard time to get our governments to listen to it. And our governments are also under pressure from the foreign governments because they have to export their coal. They want their gas company. They want their mining company to get a deal. So we have this. And what's the worst thing that's happening here in our part of the world is the governments are out there to deny us our right to say no. So the more we say yes to renewable, the government keeps on saying, no, we want faster developments, we want coal. And when we want to say no to coal, we are just being constrained with government's monitoring mechanism. So that is one thing that I see that is growing all around the world. So right to say no has to be something that has to be recognized.
Now, you mentioned that the governments are often facing conflicting goals and agendas, because if they had an opportunity to protect the environment, they would do that. But there are also more immediate concerns about, you know, provision of services, etc. And there's a lot of talk these days about cities and how urban development should proceed. And it's no secret that policies or cities were associated with the birth of civilization. And I've heard some specialists speculate that they may be also associated with the demise of both civilization and ecology. Now, the United Nations panel on climate change recently recommended smaller cities and more walkable cities. Do you think that's a workable idea? And what do you think would make living in a mid-sized city as attractive for, let's say, an average Bangladeshi or an average Russian as living in cities like Dhaka or Moscow?
Yeah, thank you. I think development models exist that can be followed, that can slow down your GDP growth. But if you think GDP is the only test of your development, you better also count how much are you losing in your GDP because of the environmental pollution. In Bangladesh, every Bangladeshi is losing 3 to 4 years of their lifespan because of air pollution. And we tend to think it's not me, it's some other Dhaka person, it's not me, it's some other Bangladeshi, but it's my mother, it's my father. We don't really think it that way. So sustainable alternatives, sustainable development models do exist, but in the rush of faster GDP, we forget the, you know, thrust for happiness. About cities, see, for Bangladesh, the reality is this is the place where you get livelihood. Livelihood is somewhat secured. So development has to be decentralized, which is not often happening in our part of the world. Everything remains city-centric. With climate change, this will aggravate further, because one-third of coastal Bangladesh, or one-third of Bangladesh, meaning the whole coastal area, might go underwater if we don't really arrest the causes of climate change very fast. So with that, more and more people will be coming to Dhaka, and this already unlivable city will probably give you a flavor of hell in this world itself. I just hope that doesn't happen. Of course, Dhaka is a car-locked city. In most cities, major cities, we find the same problem. If not walking, Cycling is also an option. Improvement of the public transportation system is also an option. So everyone has to have a car, and that car has to come out on the road every day is an idea that we have to just discard.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I may ask you one final question, and you mentioned the apocalyptic forecast that some scientists are making about the degradation of the Earth's nature. You mentioned the demise or the destruction of the coastal areas in some of the Asian countries. For some parts of Africa, the opposite is being forecast, very arid environment, enormous droughts that will make some of the land fully uninhabited. And then there is a question of 52 small island states for whom climate change is already an existential threat, a threat that has already started to manifest itself in the form of more frequent and more powerful storms and droughts. As you mentioned, the developed countries are also being impacted, but I think we would both agree that the action still falls behind the rhetoric. How bad do you think it should become before the world truly, authentically springs into action on this one?
I want to be hopeful here, although I can see that we are missing out on time. We are not addressing the problem in a timely fashion. But if you have followed the Conference of Parties this time, you have seen that the delegations extended the conference for two more days because they could not reach a consensus on loss and damage. They wanted to come up with different strategies like declaring a separate insurance scheme. They wanted to break the unity of G77 and China, but they haven't managed to do that. Even within that extended period, that is because the affected country leaders are under pressure from their communities. They went there with definite commitment that they have to come back with something to, you know, report to their people. And that is why the Bangladesh representative, the Pakistan representative, the Senegal representative, and the negotiators did not allow a crack in their unity. So, and the developed countries, despite their other efforts of, you know, declaring this insurance scheme and everything, had to bow down to this pressure. So I think pressure is on. The more the impacted communities get organized, things will probably start moving in the right direction. But we have much more organized opponents like the timber traders, fossil industry, plastic industry. How the community resistance will communicate and talk to these economic sectors, how better we will keep the pressures of these economic sectors in control would tell you how long it will take for us to, you know, go for the change that we actually need.
We unfortunately have to leave it there, but I'm really grateful for this very distressing and at the same time somewhat optimistic conversation. Thank you very much for that.
Thanks.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.